Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Good evening and welcome to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by A Lawyer Presents Evidence for the Afterlife, a book by Victor and Wendy Zammit, and that can be found at www.victorzammit.com. Tonight's guest is Paul Davids, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number here is 888-627-6008. And how are you this fine evening, Bob?
Well, thank you. And actually, we're very pleased. You know, as you know, tomorrow is begins our afterlife exploration retreat. And we have some esteemed guests that are sitting in with us this week in the studio, Dr. Betty Kovach and Kimberly Saavedra. And you might know them from the Comlock Center. And Betty and Kim have been on the show before, and it's wonderful to have them with us, and we look forward to their participation in the retreat weekend in Connecticut.
And just to be clear, that's Comlock, KAMLAK.com.
That's right. There was an article I saw in yesterday's paper or the day before where this man and his wife were in a Chinese restaurant. And usually happens in Chinese restaurants, they were given fortune cookies at the end of the meal. And the gentleman opened up his fortune cookie, and it said that he was about to hit a pot of gold. This was in Massachusetts, I believe. And he, after the meal, he went next door to the stationery store, and he bought a scratch-off ticket. And he scratched it off, and he won $1 million. So the question is, I would look at that, you know, a fortune cookie, I mean, come on. You know, that probably was the same message to, you know.
Maybe everybody in the restaurant got that same
fortune. No, but they had to print, you know, hundreds of those things.
You know who printed it? The guy in the
Well, it could be. But I like the way the media likes to jump on those things, you know. I mean, they're the first to tear down anything that's so-called paranormal in description as they happen, but they love to play up these things, and they leave what really happened up to your own imagination. But how about you, Fran? When you hear something like that, do you think that anything's connected, or just a pure coincidence?
Well, something had to prompt him to go buy that ticket. Somebody knew that somebody on the other side, very possibly, knew that there was a winning ticket there for him. But if he wasn't going to go buy it, he wasn't going to win.
So the fortune cookie was just the means that Spirit was using to orchestrate it.
Right.
I'm open to that. How about you, Betty? You open to that?
Sure, I am.
Maybe Kimberly is not open to that.
Definitely open to that.
Yeah. I think it's unanimous.
Well, we just had a little dinner, and maybe we should have eaten Chinese food. Who knows what our fortunes would have said.
It would have said, don't bother going next door. I'm buying a lotto ticket.
You know, we were discussing this a little bit at dinner, and I was thinking about it, you know, some more. And what happens, you know, we're involved in the mediumship world and with the certification program and so forth. And many times we find, not only with our certified mediums, but with other mediums, that people get referred to a medium and they go and they have this wonderful reading. And then they refer that same medium to a friend of theirs, and their friend goes to the medium and they get nothing. You know, and then, you know, and people say, well, what's the explanation for that? I mean, how would you answer that? Why does somebody get a wonderful reading and then the medium totally strikes out with it with another? Is it a reflection on the medium's ability, or
the answer is yes and no, because it depends on, there's not enough circumstances here to answer that very vast question, because there are real mediums, there are fake mediums, and there are underdeveloped mediums, and I still believe that it's not the medium as much as it is spirit. So spirit has to get through, even if it's a person who's not even a medium, that message is going to get through.
I'll buy that. So if you have one, now let's narrow the discussion to only evidential mediums, the mediums that we know are that produce evidence, you know, way beyond what you would normally expect. Might it have something to do with the sitter themselves, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, we know that it's some sort of a resonance that must take effect between the medium and the sitter and the person in spirit. And like you say, there's a lot of other information that we're not privy to. Maybe the sitter doesn't want to come through. I mean, the person in spirit doesn't want to come through. Maybe they don't like that particular medium.
Maybe there's some fear on the part of the sitter that's not allowing the whole connection to be made.
Or maybe the sitter wants to get through directly to their loved one and not necessarily through a third party.
I like that one better.
But that does happen. I bring it up because it does happen, you know, quite often. So then the second person that gets the reading says, this medium is terrible, you know. And,
right.
Which is not the case. I mean, we just don't know the factors that go into all these things. As far as the mediumship in general, I know we've touched upon this subject before, but they have a tremendous responsibility, don't you think? I mean, maybe even more so than traditional therapists, the mental, you know,
absolutely,
therapists. Because people don't necessarily go to a therapist on the fence, you know, and expect to get answers from their therapist about whether we survive physical death. But they do expect that from their experience with a medium. So, I mean, that's why I always shudder when people go to a medium for the first time, because who knows what's going to happen. And you don't want to turn somebody's belief into ashes and ashes, dust to dust, based upon their soul experience with a medium. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. What's not to agree with? I mean, it's a very delicate situation. And, you know, people watch these telemediums on TV, and, oh, I want to be a medium. Everybody wants to be a medium. Everybody's taking lessons to be a medium. And nobody gives any regard to the fact that it's a very, very serious job that the medium has. And the medium not only needs experience in evidential mediumship, but also in dealing with people who are in grief. You can't just hang up a shingle and go.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, the credible and evidential mediums are out there. I give them a tremendous amount of credit, because it is a tremendous weight on their shoulders, thinking that they really hold these fragile souls within their grasp, and they can really affect the direction that their lives take after that. So, and that's one of the reasons that we do the certification, program, because we don't want people going to practitioners that, you know, there are some, the thing that sticks with me is that a lot of, we send out, as you know, we send out these, when somebody wants to be a medium, the first step is to send out a very comprehensive questionnaire to them, and there are certain red flags that we look for. And one of the questions that we ask on that initial form is, what do you think is more important, the evidence or the message, message of love or the evidence? And a lot of them say, well, the evidence is not important, it's the message that counts. And that doesn't sit well with me, because you can't, the message has no meaning if you don't lay the groundwork with the evidence first.
Right.
So if a medium thinks that they can simply say that your love, you know, that your person in spirit loves you, yeah, I mean, a lot of people are happy to hear that, but they have to first identify the person in spirit. So to me, that's a red flag.
It is, and now you just let all the mediums that are listening know answer that question.
Well, there's many, many questions, and that's not the only one. We're going to be taking a break. We have a wonderful guest tonight, Paul Davids, who's a film producer, who just produced a movie about the afterlife. So when we come back, we'll be talking with Paul Davids. Stay with us, and we'll be back in a few.
Don't miss Forever Family Foundation's 7th Annual Conference Weekend, November 9th and 10th, this year in warm and sunny San Diego, California. In Search of the Afterlife, Experiencing, Communicating, Connecting to Another World, is designed for general audiences interested in learning about evidence of an afterlife. Attendees will be treated to cutting-edge presentations of evidence that we survive our physical deaths, as well as demonstrations of spirit communication by certified mediums. Add on the optional Friday night fundraiser dinner featuring medium Kim Russo, host of The Haunting of TV show, and stay an extra day for Media Monday. For more information, visit www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org or call 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707.
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you could find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
Victor and Wendy Zammit, researchers of the afterlife for over 30 years, have released their new book. A Lawyer Presents the Evidence for the Afterlife, What Really Happens When We Die. It has received rave reviews and is a comprehensive look at all of the evidence, including physical mediumship, near-death experiences, deathbed visions, after-death contacts, reincarnation, and a host of other phenomena that will prove that we are much more than our physical bodies. To learn more or to sign up for their free newsletter, visit www.victorzammit.com. That's www.victorzammit.com.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide support for families who have suffered the loss of a loved one. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707 or on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
Tuning in, our guest tonight is Paul Davids. Our sponsor is A Lawyer Presents the Evidence for the Afterlife, a book by Victor and Wendy Zammit, and that can be found at www.victorzammit.com. Bob?
And we're happy to have our guest, Paul Davids. Paul is a graduate of Princeton University, where he majored in psychology and won numerous writing awards. He later attended the American Film Institute Center for Advanced Film Studies and then went on to work on film and in TV. He produced and directed 9 feature films just in the last decade, including Showtime's Roswell, which I imagine is the movie that put him on the map. His latest film is The Life After Death Project, and it's a film that centers around after-death communication and other evidence that we survive our physical deaths. Paul is also a prolific artist and a writer, and his works can be found at 2 websites, pauldavids.com, and also the movie website, lifeafterdeathproject.com. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, Bob. Thank you for having me.
And, you know, obviously we're talking about your career. You've had a long career in film. Let's just say you've taken on projects that sometimes buck mainstream thought. You know, and before making Life After Death, I mean, did you have any personal experiences that caused you to want to learn more about the possibility that we survive?
No. You know, I was probably would have been in the skeptical camp.
Right.
Although, let me put it this way. I was very intrigued by Hindu thought and their beliefs in reincarnation, and had read the writings of Paramahansa Yogananda. And when I went to India to make the film Jesus in India, of course I came into closer contact with a lot of those ideas. It doesn't mean I made those ideas my own or really felt that I had anything to go on, you know, to know. But I tell everyone that I didn't choose to make this film. It chose me. I really feel like it was an assignment. And it came from somewhere else, and I was the stooge who was picked by people unseen and not physically here. And this is really the way I feel after this journey of, it's been 4 years.
Right.
And it began with the death of my very dear friend, Forrest J. Ackerman. A very famous man, died at age 92. So
yeah.
That's when it started, after he passed.
Yeah, and as you say, the film centers on after-death communication from Forrest Ackerman. So tell us a little bit about Forrest. I mean, if you weren't involved in that genre, you know, of mystery.
You probably wouldn't know him if you weren't involved. But
yeah.
He was born in 1916,
yeah.
And his life reflected the whole growth of the movies from the silent era, and he was particularly intrigued by science fiction films, horror films from the days of the really early horror films. I mean, Lon Chaney was one of his first admired stars, and Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi, and then came Peter Lorre and Christopher Lee, all of them. He collected memorabilia from all of these movies through the decades, and eventually moved to an 18-room house. He called it the Acker Mansion, and it was absolutely filled with memorabilia from these movies, and art, and posters, and literature in the genre. His maternal grandfather was a very famous man who, architect, designed the Bradbury Building in Los Angeles, where they filmed Blade Runner. And one of his ancestors was a photographer who photographed Abraham Lincoln. And he kept the chair that Abraham Lincoln sat in, as the story goes, you know, on display in this Acker Mansion that everybody could visit. So his other claim to fame was editor of Famous Monsters of Filmland magazine. And a lot of you may never have heard of it. It is still being published, but it started in 1958, and for my generation of young boys growing up in the late 50s and 60s, you know, we were obsessed with that magazine. It was the only one of its kind, and it was really, really funny. It gave you, you know, pictures from all of these horror movies, but always with Fari Ackerman's hilarious captions, you know, that were aimed at, you know, at boys between 10 and 14, really. And so he had film contests. I entered one when I was a kid. I was a winner. I was publicized in this magazine. That's how I got to know him. And then after Princeton, I went to Hollywood, studied at the American Film Institute, spent a lot of time with him at the Acker Mansion, studying the whole archives, and knew him really, really, really well, let's say, for a solid 40 years.
Now, I mean, I don't want to give away too much of the movie, but it never has an ink blot been scrutinized as much as it was by you and these scientists. So you have to tell us how this started with the with this ink blot on a
yes, it started. It started with an incident that goes like this. We had the tribute for him at the Hollywood Egyptian Theater, hundreds of people there. A couple of filmmakers from Canada went to his crypt had a really strange experience where within an hour they were both convinced they had heard from him. And I heard the story from them. And they were very sincere and sounded very believable. It was an incredible story. And I just sort of filed it away in my mind. But in about a week, I was alone in my vacation house in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And these were the circumstances. I printed out a document for tax purposes, a review of phone calls and business meetings of the last year, 24 pages. So it was so long that I pressed the print command, and then I left. I went out for about an hour or so, and when I came back, the document was dry. It was normal. I stapled it. I tossed it on the bed in the main floor bedroom, and I went into the bathroom for a few minutes. And it was when I came out that my life changed because of what happened, and it has never been the same ever since. Because we call it an ink blot. The scientists called it an ink obliteration. The skeptics call it a smudge, but it's not a smudge. There was a line on the document that had moist ink over four of the words. And it was very precise. It was exact. It was targeted. It was clearly those words had been chosen. And here's the dilemma. I was alone in the house. I didn't do it. I'm not partial to fugue states. I had no idea I was going to discover this. It dried in about a few minutes. And when it dried, you could see that the level of opaqueness or opacity was different over some of the words. Two words you could still kind of read. Two words completely blacked out. Now, my dilemma was, I was alone in the house. I could tell that this was a deliberate act. You might presume a message of some kind. I didn't know what the message was. I was frightened. I was scared. You know, I felt like someone would feel that had us in the presence of a specter. But I treated it as evidence. You know, I didn't touch it. And within a week, I was in touch with one of the top chemists in the country, Dr. Jay Siegel, University of Indiana, chairman of the chemistry department, forensic chemist, very famous in his field, has testified in a lot of trials, and he's an expert in inks and solvents and paints. And he invited me to, first he said, you know, FedEx me the document, but I would not let it leave my hand. I got on a plane. He agreed I could bring my video equipment to film what he did in the lab. I wanted to get to the bottom of, could he tell me how this ink blot happened? What was it? I was looking for meaning any way I could find it. And this started an immense investigation that continued for 3 years, eventually involved three colleges, universities, because Dr. John Allison of the College of New Jersey became involved with electron microscope work on this. Eventually, Dr. Gary Schwartz at University of Arizona became involved in different facets of the interpretation of it. However, the scientists were really baffled by the data and very disturbed by the fact that no matter what solvent they tried, and they tried hundreds over 3 years, they couldn't duplicate the effect of that ink obliteration. They couldn't reproduce it. It was altogether too even, and there was never enough ink there on the page to begin with to completely black out two words. They could never black out two words from any solvent. So it's unexplained. It's completely unexplained. So now the door is open to interpretation. Now I want to say, the skeptics, you'll read reviews of the Life After Death Project, and I would say among the skeptics and the debunkers, most of them never even mention the case of this ink blot that got it started. They just stay away from it completely. Or they distort the facts. I mean, the last review I read, I was surprised to hear that I was in a hotel room when this happened. You know, if you say this happened in a hotel room, somebody could say, well, you know, a lot of people have keys to a hotel room. You go in the bathroom, maybe somebody slipped in. The point is, the scientists decided, they can't figure out how it was done. So, you know, somebody just suddenly deciding to do something with a solvent, it doesn't seem possible. It's unexplained. So then comes the interpretation of, well, what did it mean? And that's where it gradually dawned on me that it was a specific message. And the words, the humor involved in it, the sort of pun, the word within a word, was so specific to the kind of thing that my dear friend Forrest J. Ackerman always did as a magazine editor. It was his own particular trademark to find a word within a word and emphasize it and make a word game or a word twist out of it. So the fact that it had that to it, that was a reference to his closest caretaker of the last 10 years, and the fact that I'd heard the story from the two guys from Canada who'd knocked on his crypt and what had happened, made me think, you know, it's got to be possible. Got to be possible that the man is still here, not in body. And what I've experienced now, Bob and Fran, over the last 4 years now, is so many repeated incidents, some of them with physical evidence, a number of them involving the movement of various things, and sometimes specifically referring to Fari Ackerman, sometimes even affecting misprints in a published magazine about him, where an article was written, and suddenly in the middle of the article it starts saying, "The ink blot, two levels of opacity," and then gives the four words and repeats it again and again and again in Fate magazine. It wasn't there when it went to print. It wasn't written like that. You know, how does it happen?
Mm. Well, you know, Paul, as you know, I mean, that there is a lot of evidence that seems to indicate that strong emotions play a part in telepathic communication. You've already described, you know, Fari Ackerman as a larger-than-life character.
He was, absolutely.
So it seems to reason that some people are better able than others to make things happen, even from this other realm of existence. So it seems in line with your description of Fari. But you also mention in the film that Forrest Ackerman was skeptical of survival. So and
yes.
He even mentioned that he said to some of his friends that if he was wrong, he'd drop him a line from the other side. So I would imagine when he said that, you didn't pay much attention to it, but you do now.
Yeah, it was like a joke at the time. It was like done with a wink. And when you talk about him as a larger-than-life figure, he was, and you look him up, you'll discover, he was the ultimate Pied Piper for science fiction, fantasy, and horror, who through his magazine led all the kids of that time, who are now absolutely the top people of the business, into this field, including everyone you can name, from Lucas and Spielberg and Peter Jackson and Guillermo del Toro and John Landis and Dennis Muren and Rick Baker. And the list goes on and on and on and on. Joe Dante, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's me. I made Roswell, and I wrote a lot of Star Wars books, so I'm part of it.
Right.
But he was this Svengali, this Pied Piper. And what was the result of his influence? It's America's largest export to the world now, these science fiction and special effects films. It's a huge multi-billion dollar industry. And it was nothing when Fari was starting. I mean, these things were little special effects experiments people did in their garages. And, you know, nobody quite knew where it was going when they made The Invisible Man or Things to Come or some of the early movies like that. So he was a great man of influence and a futurist and a forward thinker and an Esperantist into language. The point is, if anybody was going to do it to make communication and have the will and correct the mistake of having been wrong about this, it would have been him. He would have done it. And Richard Matheson, the great, great writer who passed away very recently, just a matter of weeks ago, for those who don't know him by name, you've seen Somewhere in Time with Christopher Reeve and Jane Seymour, and you've seen What Dreams May Come with Robin Williams, and going all the way back to the early Twilight Zones and The Incredible Shrinking Man, and he wrote I Am Legend. I mean, the man was a legend, Richard Matheson. He was a friend of Fari's.
Yeah.
And he says in the film, you know, Paul, I'm very prepared to believe it. He said, I think Fari corrected himself after the fact that, you know, he didn't believe in these things, and when he passed over and discovered he was wrong, those are Richard Matheson's words, discovered he was wrong, he decided to do something very practical about it and let you know. That's what I think happened. And here's the great man, Richard Matheson. He's convinced. Many were convinced. And then there are those debunkers and the skeptics who are so ferociously closed-minded. They can't let the door open even a crack. It threatens something. So there's such an arrogant superiority complex in a lot of people who have to reject this as some kind of obvious exploitation without knowing anything about it, Bob.
Well, that's true. And also, you also didn't mention that some of them have built quite lucrative careers out of being professional debunkers. it's not necessarily...
It's an industry. Yeah, yes. Michael Shermer, who I invited into the movie, who's a very intelligent man. I don't agree with a lot of his opinions, but I like to listen to him, and I have read his books, Why People Believe Weird Things and The Believing Brain. You know, he says, the believing brain, we're prone to believe certain things, so we will. But I think he misses a very fundamental point in claiming that belief precedes these incidents and these phenomena. For example, he would point out a very religious person, you know, lying on the grass after a picnic and looking up at the sky and seeing a cloud that looks like an angel might be quick to say that that's a sign from God, whereas a meteorologist is going to say, you know, it's not. It's water vapor. You know, it's a coincidental shape. So he says in The Believing Brain, belief comes first, and then you hear these things that people say happen to them.
Yeah.
I find that's not true in most cases. You'll see in The Life After Death Project and the sequel, which comes with it, by the way, in the DVD. We got the two of them together. So when you get one, you get the other. But I find that many times the people that report phenomena never had a thought about this before, never had a belief about it, that the phenomena came first, and it was dealing with what happened to them that began to create belief. And as far as Shermer's book, you know, Why People Believe Weird Things, you know, he makes the case people believe weird things because there are weird people with weird interests, right?
Of course.
I'm going to say, you know, people believe weird things because there are weird things. It's a fact, and science should come to grips with it and expand its horizons, and I think it will. I absolutely think it will, and knowledge of these things will be commonplace, maybe within our lifetime.
Hmm. Well, you know, we're going to go to a break soon, but before we do, I mean, it's to follow up on that, as somebody that obviously has the pulse on the film industry, and as you mentioned, there have been many big, huge grossing movies that had paranormal themes and afterlife themes. Do you think that the media has within its power to change worldview on something like life after death?
Well, I don't think that there's any force in the mainstream media today that would make that happen out of any interest in truth in their heart. You know, it's a very, very commercially motivated business, and that's why you get things like, you know, the Blair Witch Project or the Fourth Kind or things that are patently untrue that they try to suck people into believing and create a cult out of. And I think that's wrong, but they'll do it, and they'll probably always do it. But the media can help. I think it's people who have the motivation like I do, who have the power and ability to make a film, make a project, because they care about telling something that's true and helping to educate the public and trying to crack through that wall of the debunkers. So I'm contributing to it. But I want to say, you know, also that piracy, film piracy on the internet can make all this go away, because it's destroying our business, absolutely destroying our business. And I ask everybody to turn away from that, and please support the independent filmmakers whose work you believe in.
Well, it's a good thing that you're also a very good artist and writer, so you have something else to do.
Yeah. Well, I've made a lot of films. I've had a wonderful run, and I've chosen, for the most part, it's been the topics I wanted to choose, and almost every one of them, I've known that it was going to really get under somebody's skin, that it was going to challenge the way they think, and it would open minds, and those that were open would be helped to further understandings through my films, and those who were opposed and close-minded to it would become angry, and that's been borne out. But that's my choice. That's what I've decided to do.
Well, that's all you can do, and I applaud you for that. All you can do is open minds and present the evidence, and let people take it from there. We're talking with Paul Davids, his website is pauldavids.com. There's a link to the movie on lifeafterdeathproject.com. There's also a link to purchase the movie on a Forever Family Foundation website, which you can do. So we're going to go to a break. We're going to come back with much more with Paul. So stay with us.
Don't miss Forever Family Foundation's 7th Annual Conference Weekend, November 9th and 10th, this year in warm and sunny San Diego, California. In Search of the Afterlife, Experiencing, Communicating, Connecting to Another World, is designed for general audiences interested in learning about evidence of an afterlife. Attendees will be treated to cutting-edge presentations of evidence that we survive our physical deaths, as well as demonstrations of spirit communication by certified mediums. Add on the optional Friday night fundraiser dinner featuring medium Kim Russo, host of The Haunting of TV show, and stay an extra day for Media Monday. For more information, visit www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org or call 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide support for families who have suffered the loss of a loved one. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707 or on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
Victor and Wendy Zammit, researchers of the afterlife for over 30 years, have released their new book, A Lawyer Presents the Evidence for the Afterlife, What Really Happens When We Die. It has received rave reviews and is a comprehensive look at all of the evidence, including physical mediumship, near-death experiences, deathbed visions, after-death contacts, reincarnation, and a host of other phenomena that will prove that we are much more than our physical bodies. To learn more or to sign up for their free newsletter, visit www.victorzammit.com. That's www.victorzammit.com.
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
if you are just tuning in, our guest tonight is Paul Davids. This show is sponsored by A Lawyer Presents the Evidence for the Afterlife, a book by Victor and Wendy Zammit, and that can be found at www.victorzammit.com. If you are a business interested in advertising on our show, please contact us via email at radio@foreverfamilyfoundation.org or call the office at 631-425-7707. Before we get back to our show, we have a few important foundation updates for our listeners. Our Visa credit card and ways of letting us know you like Signs of Life Radio. Whoa, I can't speak tonight. Visit us on Facebook and like us and let us know that you like the show. You can use the donate button on any one of our weekly email show reminders to support programming. There's also a little space to add a comment on what you love and what you might not like so much about the show. And then remember us when you shop. Yes, when you shop, you can support the work of our 100% volunteer not-for-profit organization without spending any additional money at all. First, you will need a credit card to shop online. So if you don't already have one or are in need of another, go to foreverfamilyfoundation.org and apply for the Visa credit card. Visa will make a donation to us for each card that's taken out, and each time the card is used, a portion of that charge is donated back to Forever Family Foundation. Second, if your shopping takes you to the Internet, consider shopping at Amazon.com, but first use the link on the Forever Family Foundation website, and again, a portion of your spending comes back to support our work. Now, if you don't see what you want on Amazon, then sign up with iGive.com and name Forever Family Foundation as the charity of your choice. Then search iGive.com for your items. For each search, we receive a donation. And when you find what you are looking for in the more than 1,300 online stores like Lego, Lord & Taylor, Mattel, Radio Shack, a portion of what you spend is again donated back to Forever Family Foundation. So please take a few moments when you shop to show us that you care. Our 7th annual Afterlife Conference will be held this year in beautiful and warm San Diego, California, at the DoubleTree by Hilton Golf Resort, November 9th and 10th. Mark the dates as this will be the best one ever. The big member-only discount ends on July 31st next week, so make your plans now for the Friday night banquet featuring Kim Russo, star of the TV hit series The Haunting of. She'll be the keynote presenter, bringing through communication from the other side. Then the conference begins early Saturday morning through Sunday evening, including featured presentations by Tom and Lisa Butler of the Association Transcommunication, Dr. Jeffrey Tarrant demonstrating brain changes in mediums during communication, research medium Janet Mayer, Dr. Stephen E. Browdy, Dr. Evan Alexander, and Lloyd Auerbach with spirit communication demonstrations from certified mediums Laura Lynn Jackson and Angelina Diana. And as a special add-on this year, we will bring you Medium Monday. So check the website for registration information now. Our holidays past raffle is in full swing, and you might want to get in while the number assignments are low, since a computer program pulls the winners by assigned numbers. The mediums in this raffle are Dave Campbell, Eliza Ray, Nancy Marlowe, Tracy Lee Nash, and Catherine Nadell. It's $5 a chance. Back to you, Bob.
And thanks to Paul for hanging in there with us during those announcements. The film is Life After Death Project. The website is lifeafterdeathproject.com. We've been talking about evidence of an afterlife. Paul, I wanted to bring up, I know there's a part in your film where you interviewed Mark Macy. For those that don't know him, he's a well-known and an accomplished researcher of electronic voice phenomena. And during the interview, there were many anomalies that appeared on the film. As a matter of fact, at one point, his face seems to morph. Did you see anything out of the ordinary while you were filming, or was this only noticed after you played it back?
It was only noticed after we played it back, and it was the fact that we had two cameras on him at that time, and that both cameras were having the same anomalies happening that caused me to say, wait a minute, what's going on here? Because, you know, you can imagine some sort of glitch with one camera, although I haven't really seen anything quite like that. But the fact that it happened with both cameras, and he was talking about and emphasizing the idea that in the spirit world that that there can be interference with electromagnetic fields of our equipment when they're, I guess the word would be trying to get through to us in some way, that the communication sometimes happens through the manipulation of the electromagnetic fields. And this can happen, he says, with, you know, with computers or radio, or it can happen with video. And that's, you know, that's what happened in that case. It really surprised me that it happened.
Yeah, well,
it was very odd.
Very evidential that it happened in both cameras. I could imagine you're sitting there in the editing room and saying, "Oh, Fari, hello." You know, so, I mean,
well, but you know, the way the first reaction was from the fellow who was the cameraman who called me to notify it, because he had the materials, and he said, "Oh no, I got bad news for you. You know, this didn't come out right. You know, it's all messed up." He says, "But maybe you can cover yourself on the messed up parts, you know, with the other camera." And then comes the phone call saying, "Oh no, I've looked at the other camera. You're not going to believe this." You know, so at first it's treated like a tragedy, and then we discover, wait a minute, this is really prima facie evidence of what he's talking about. But I'll tell you this, and this is kind of funny, but all of these films go through quality control before they get released, and I'm having to explain to every one of these quality control personnel. That wait a minute, that messed up video is supposed to be that way. You know, that's part of the story now. You know, I mean, it's part of the evidence. So don't reject it from quality control because that's in there. And I have to send them the time codes to look for where. And I even put on the screen, you know, this is the original footage and this is the way it happened. But you don't often see that in the sequel movie. Life After Death Project 2, Personal Encounters. Whole additional film, lots and lots of other experiences and other cases, and I packed that in with the first movie, so you get two movies with it.
Right.
And in that one, toward the end, I dealt with the extraordinary fact that when we were trying to output the final movie of the first one that was going to go on Sci-Fi Channel, and it was going to be the final output, you know, to create the broadcast master. And somehow the soundtrack vanished in the middle of the movie. Even though it was all fine on the computer and the hard drives, everything indicated no problem. So I looked through it to see, okay, where did the sound drop out? And the irony is, it was just at the very point that a caregiver who was with Fari the moment he died was commenting on a painting of Fari, making a silence gesture that had a raven, and it was all about death, and painted 4 years before he died, and it had a clock right at 2 minutes to midnight, which is right when he died, you know, 4 years before he died, the clock was right. But just as this fellow is saying, you know, and he's saying, and you know, the shush gesture, the silence of death, extraordinary, bang, right at that moment, no more soundtrack. Silence. Deathly silent from there to the end of the film. We didn't do anything to make it happen. How does it happen? How does it happen that at that exact moment the sound goes? It's like a self-referential signal. Mm. You can't deny it.
Yeah,
you know, you can say it's an accident, but if it's an accident, there's one chance in 200,000 that it would happen on that very frame in the movie. And then you got to somehow explain why it would happen. And there was nothing wrong with the equipment. Nothing.
Yeah. It's interesting that most filmmakers, when these things were happening, like the anomalies and what you just described, they would be going, "Oh, crap, you know, why is this happening to me?"
Well, I did. Yeah, I did. That was my first reaction. It was, "Oh, no, I have to do it again. It took 12 hours to render this."
Yeah.
But then you say, wait a minute. It was like when I saw the misprint in Fate magazine, and I'd written an article about the Fari Ackerman case, and, you know, I wanted the article to be perfect. And I look, and page one has, wait a minute, how did they screw up? It has this repeating again and again and again about the ink blot. I didn't even put it there.
Yeah.
You know? So you're either the skeptic who says, oh, it was a fluke, you know, just a wild accident, doesn't mean anything. Or you say, the man's trying to get through to you. He's trying to get your attention.
Right.
You know?
So now you made a previous film that centered around reincarnation. You have this film that deals with after-death communication. I mean, you've touched on other forms of evidence in the film, near-death experiences, you know, mediumship, electronic voice phenomena. Personally, what do you think is the strongest evidence for survival? Or have you thought about that?
Well, I have. And I know there were some people who would say, well, it's reincarnation, because you look at some cases, you look at even Stevenson's research and his work, and that's the answer. And for other people, it's the near-death experience, like Dr. Eben Alexander, who you mentioned, or Danny and Brinkley, who's in my film. But for me, it is now this phenomena of after-death communication, the fact that there's an echo. There's a ripple in time and space that a personality leaves here, and something is remaining that can still tug at us. And I don't know how much time we have, but there's a little comparison I'd like to make.
Okay.
I work with a stroke patient, and you know, a stroke can just obliterate part of the brain, and you feel it's just not there anymore. A person can't speak; they're paralyzed, and in one case, with a dear relative, we didn't know whether we could communicate at all, but she could move her one hand. And I said, you know, squeeze my hand. Just squeeze my hand. I'm holding you. And you don't know, first of all, whether she still understands the word squeeze, whether she understands even what you're saying. And the next question is, can she do it? Can she give you a response? And then just very lightly, you know, it's very subtle, the hand just puts a little pressure on your hand. And that's the best squeeze she can do, you know. But what does it tell you? It tells you she's still there, she understands what you said, and she responded to it. Now, what I'm saying, and what I think a lot of your work is saying, Bob and Fran, is that if you listen, if you're attentive, you'll see those little signs that are like the universe squeezing your hand, and you're getting a message from somewhere else, and you need to be attentive to pay attention. Because if you're not, and you're just all caught up in your normal everyday stuff and your worries, then you get an ink blot like I got, and all that happens is you say, damn, why did this happen? You know, what a bother. Now I got to print the thing out again. And what did it say? Oh, I can't even read it. How did that happen? And you crumple it up and you throw it away and you print it out again, and then you think you're right back where you were before.
Right.
And you may have missed the most important thing that's ever happened in your life.
That's well said. And when people watch the film, you know, it's easy to take each isolated incident and write it off to coincidence. But when you sit back and you look at the entire body of evidence, then you're opening up minds, and that is what we appreciate.
It's overwhelming, at that point.
We have been talking with Paul Davids. I encourage you to go to pauldavids.com. Not only can you learn about all his films, but you can also link to his artwork. And as he mentioned, he did write the whole Star Wars.
So six Star Wars sequels, books. That was
and,
it.
The movie is Life After Death Project. There's also a sequel. You can go to lifeafterdeathproject.com. Thanks, Paul. I appreciate you being with us tonight, and I hope you can come back and join us again.
I'd love to. Thank you so much.
All right, thanks. Have a good evening.
You too.
We now ask our listeners to please join us in our Healing Energy Circle prayer. May the universe create a channel of healing energy from all participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind, as we visualize the healing light upon Johnny Jackson, Pat Amendolari, Griffin Alexander, Kimberly Saavedra, Lynn Cheney, Rachel S., Lenny Ficarelli, Joel Auerbach, Janice Borelli, Jeanette Davies, Dorothy Mello, Andy O'Brien, Tanya Cash, Marianne Pierzga, Laura Prisco, John Borland, Stanley Mulan, Julie B., Glenna Irwin, Barbara Petillo, David Hayes, Rita Springer, Eileen Lafada, Mark Farron, Wendy Lippo, Vicky Steffi, Barbara Russell, Tina Jossen, Deb Martin, Tim Donahue, and Francis Mastracco. And now, let us as one consciousness give our energy of loving thought by praying like this: to love one another, to treat others as we would like to be treated, to forgive others and return love for hate, kindness for anger, to spread this feeling to everyone, to our fellow man, as well as the earth and its environment. And now it's time to say,
our loved ones are only a heartbeat away, and science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.